Welcome everyone. This is Beverly Tomasian. I'm excited to greet all of you to our Diabetes Bootcamp Class 3. Today's an exciting topic. We're going to be talking about insulin therapy, insulin management, basal bolus, pattern recognition, how to adjust insulin. So this is a really interesting webcast and also one that's really important to our daily experience and the daily provision as diabetes educators. We certainly do help people identify where their insulin therapy is working and what changes can be made to improve outcomes, blood sugars, and quality of life. I do want to point out that about 2 hours after we're done broadcasting this webcast, there is also a podcast available on our Diabetes University website. So if you want to download a podcast, it's available, and the online course is available within a few hours afterward. It takes us a little time to get things set up, but Lainey and I are hard at work behind the scenes. And here's Lainey Koski, our VP of Operations. So she's holding down the fort as we're doing this webcast, and she's available to answer any questions, technical questions, before or after the program. During the program, if you're having any difficulty, I would encourage you to contact Citrix, and they're our web host provider, and they can help you with on-the-fly problem solving. For Bootcamp 3, here's the articles that go along with it. And I do just want to point out a few of them that we've talked about before. The ACE Comprehensive Diabetes Management Algorithm, a slide set summary. Also important, AD algorithm for type 2 diabetes, ADA algorithm. There's an AADE white paper on continuous subcutaneous insulin therapy or insulin pump therapy. We're not going to cover insulin pump too much during this program. We're going to talk about basal bolus, which is the essential operation behind the pump, but I would encourage you to read this paper, which will really help hone in on the critical areas to know about insulin pump therapy. And then there's another great article here, AADE Strategies for Insulin Therapy, published 2011, a real nice summary of insulin therapy, frequently asked questions. It debunks some mythology, and I think it's a real excellent review of insulin therapy. So what are we going to talk about today? Wow, we've got a lot to cover. Discuss the actions of different insulins, look at pattern management as an insulin adjustment tool, look at basal bolus therapy, and also we're going to do some calculations. So here's the human proinsulin molecule. This is actually what insulin looks like stored in your beta cells, and it's called proinsulin because it's ready at a moment's notice to be activated into the active molecule insulin. So you can see there's an alpha and a beta chain, and those are the two chains that consist of insulin. And then here's the connecting peptide. The C-peptide holds this proinsulin molecule together until the insulin is activated. When proinsulin is turned into insulin, the C-peptide is cleaved off. And at the same time, insulin and the C-peptide enter the bloodstream. Insulin passes first through the portal vein of the liver, so 50% of it is utilized right away. C-peptide goes through the kidney, so it has a longer half-life. So often when we're measuring how much endogenous insulin a person makes, we'll look at C-peptide. It's a more hearty measurement of actual endogenous insulin production. Here's Dr. Banting and Best with Marjorie at the University of Toronto. In 1920s, there was no treatment for type 1 diabetes. And Dr. Banting right here and Best, his colleague, were doing a lot of great research where they were actually taking the pancreases out of dogs. So they were essentially inducing type 1 diabetes. And when they did that, they took the pancreas that they took from the dogs, they ground it up, and they got the fluid from the pancreas and injected it back into the dog. So they would induce diabetes, they would monitor their blood sugars and saw that, yes, the blood sugars go up without a pancreas. They would take the fluid from the pancreas they had taken out, and then they would inject it back into the dog. Marjorie was the first dog who lived for about 43 days on injected insulin. And when they gave her the insulin, they saw a direct causal relationship. Insulin made blood sugars go down. And insulin let Marjorie live those 43 days without a pancreas. So this was a very exciting turnaround point. It was the University of Toronto, the year 1921. It was a hot summer, but they went, they published their paper, and there was a worldwide hubbub. Finally, there's a treatment. There's a liquid. There's something we can give children with type 1 diabetes to help them live. And this photo we've taken a look at in the first boot camp. Here's this little boy with type 1 diabetes. He makes no insulin, so he's used muscle and fat for energy. He is failure to thrive. Finally, though, his mother took him up to Banting and Best. 1922, that little boy got some insulin. Here's some of the first insulins. This is produced by Eli Lilly, Elentin. And this is insulin produced by the University of Toronto. Well, the University of Toronto couldn't keep up with the demand, so Eli Lilly took over and really ramped up production. The first insulins were brown, they were thick, they were not pure, they were not standard dosing, but the patients didn't care about all that because you gave that insulin injection and those kids lived. It was a new lease on life. Here is our little boy, JL, December 15th, 1922, made it up to Banting and Best, received insulin therapy, and here is that same little boy 2 months later. This is only after 2 months of insulin therapy, which is really so remarkable. Doesn't he look a lot happier? Well, probably not that much happier, but he's got some chubby cheeks, so now you can see he's no longer losing fat. He's no longer losing glucose for energy. He actually is able to store fat and glucose and glycogen. So he's really no longer failure to thrive, and this little boy lived a long life. And so insulin really turned a lot of children's lives around. So a lot of times my patients say to me, I don't want to go on insulin. I don't want to take a shot. And I think of this little boy and all the children who came after him and all the adults who have lived because of insulin therapy. So let's just start off with a poll question. John has type 2 diabetes and need to start insulin. He tells you, there is no way I'm going to take insulin. What is your best response? And so when we think about the exam, they are going to ask questions about people's response to insulin. And using our adult learning theories and other knowledge of how to help support people make changes, we would have to answer this type of question. This would be a very common type of question they would ask regarding that. And again, I'm going to ask you to differentiate the best response. So there may be more than one right apparent response, but what is the best? Okay. Thank you all for voting. I'll take one more second. All right, let's close and share. And so, nobody chose, don't worry, insulin won't cause weight gain. Okay, great, because that is actually not true. When people go on insulin therapy, they do gain weight. And I would say average 3 to 7 pounds is about the average, but I do say to them, when you go on insulin and you gain weight, it's a sign of your body healing. Your body is recovering. It's able to store energy. So I help them reframe that weight gain, and I really work with them not to gain much more than that. Okay, nobody chose that. B, insulin will prevent complications. B and C are true. B is true. Insulin will help prevent complications. It's not going to prevent all complications. Some people still get complications, even if they go on insulin, because maybe we started too late. So that's not really correct. C is not correct either. The new needles don't hurt at all because the needles do hurt a little bit. So we want to be honest with people and say, these needles, when you inject them, you know, they're so small, they hardly cause any pain at all. And some people even say they don't even notice them. But we don't want to say they don't hurt at all. That's not exactly 100% true. And the real thing we want to get to is what 93% of you chose. Tell me why. The best way, great job, everyone. The best way when people say, no, I don't want to do something, is you want to ask them, tell me why. What's stopping you? Tell me about how you're feeling regarding insulin. And that is one of the best ways to kind of overcome this, what we call psychological insulin resistance. About 50% of providers in this study, they looked at why people don't want to start insulin, actually were threatened with a needle. And less than 50% of providers realized that insulin actually has a positive effect on type 2. And many people don't believe that insulin will really help them manage their diabetes. They just kind of think it's a punishment for failing their diabetes. So how do we treat it? We want to find out the root cause, address it. And it even says here, use more insulin pens. And I'll tell you why it says use more insulin pens. If you look at these little needles up top, the BD Mini and the BD Nano, which are used on insulin pens, and then the BD Short, look at the original needle, how long it is. So these shorter needles, people are able to use them more readily. They don't look at the needle and freak out as much. There's not as much phobia around it. So always use short needle. And then some people say, well, Bev, what if they're really obese? Is a short needle enough? Yes, it is. Insulin is a subcutaneous injection. We want to get it into the fat. We do not want to get into the muscle. So short needles are totally fine. And they work. I had a patient come in to see me. He was giving injections in his leg. And like many men I work with, he didn't have very much fat on his leg. So he was really giving intramuscular injections. And you could feel the bumps on his leg. So always feel where people are injecting to see if they're going to the same site over and over again and getting those lipodystrophies and exaggerated bumps in their skin from injecting in the same spot. Okay, and then I have here considered inhaled insulin. What? Inhaled insulin? Is it available? Yes, it is. We're really excited about it. We'll talk about that in a second. But anyways, I had a patient come in to see me just last Tuesday, and I asked permission to take his picture because he came in, and we had to adjust his insulin therapy. I never met him before, but he came in with this tackle box with all of his diabetes supplies, and I'm like, this is amazing. So he had his insulin needles, his meter, his strips, his alcohol. It was awesome. So I'm like, can I take a picture? He's like, sure. And he was so proud of this. It was a $499 tackle box from Walmart. And so you can see just looking at this patient, let me go back, how enthusiastic he was about managing his diabetes. And the one thing that he hadn't been able to achieve is keeping a log of his blood sugars. So he's going to work on a log book too, which is pretty exciting. Okay, so the thing we want to do when we're working with patients on insulin therapy is we definitely want to start thinking like a pancreas. So this will help direct us in the way we need to go. When we work with patients on insulin therapy, we want to look at their logbook to see how their blood sugars are responding and their insulin dose and, of course, any other oral medications they're on. We want to look at the food they're eating and also their activity level. All of those things are going to influence what their blood sugars do. All right. So the first thing I want to start off with is mealtime glucose. So you can see this person doesn't have diabetes because their mealtime glucose never goes above 140. Their pancreas is squirting out enough insulin to prevent postprandial hyperglycemia. So they're making enough juice is what I call it. So here we go. This patient or this person's eating. Every meal, their blood sugar spikes up. Here's a spike. And then lunch, they must have eaten a little bit less. And then dinner, they had a spike in their glucose. Now, what does the pancreas do in response? Well, it releases bolus insulin. So the pancreas gets a message, and the message is blood sugars are on the rise. So the pancreas goes, I better activate my proinsulin that we just looked at, cleave it off, and get some insulin into circulation. So what I'd like you to do, if you have them with you, or you can print them out right now, let's look at your insulin pocket cards. In your insulin pocket cards, you can download them on our website, are really a great study tool. But if we're going to imitate bolus insulin by injection, which insulins are bolus insulins? Which insulins can we use to cover what we would call mealtime glucose excursions? And if you look on your card, you can see it's aspart, lispro, glulysine, or regular. Those are all bolus insulins. So a person with diabetes, since they don't make enough mealtime insulin, we will need to imitate the work of the pancreas by giving them bolus insulins to cover hyperglycemia associated with meals and hyperglycemia associated with other issues like infection, illness, and so forth. So We want to imitate the pancreas work as far as bolus insulin, and we do that through aspart, lispro, Humalog, and regular. But guess what? The pancreas is not just working during mealtimes. It's working 24/7. That pancreas is releasing about 0.5 units of insulin every hour. It's called basal insulin. Why does it do that? Well, look at here. There's basal glucose down below. You have to maintain a steady resource of glucose so your brain can work, so your muscles can work, so you can function normally. It's the fuel in your gas tank. Glucose is the fuel. But if you don't keep that fuel in check, it can go very high. And I'll tell you what basal insulin really helps control. It's the liver. You see, the liver stores glycogen, and basal insulin tells the liver, do not release glycogen stores. we're okay. So a lot of our patients with type 2 diabetes, they don't make enough insulin, basal insulin. They're not secreting that much insulin through the night. So you'll notice they'll have a lot of high morning blood sugars. Why? Because the liver is releasing sugar throughout the night. They wake up with high fastings. One of the ways to treat high fasting blood sugars is by giving basal insulin at night. Or you can give basal insulin in the morning if it's a 24-hour insulin. Basal insulin helps to regulate basal glucose. Basal insulin helps regulate the liver's output of glycogen. So to control blood sugars, we need a blending of bolus insulin and basal. Basal insulin is about, generally speaking, people release about 0.5 units an hour. And if you go on an insulin pump, that's what you'll see. Patients are on basal insulin, 0.5 to 1 unit an hour. They vary throughout the day. And then they take bolus insulin with food. And that's what an insulin pump does. It tries to imitate the work of the pancreas. If you don't have a pump, you do it with needles. So you do it with injections. Basal insulins include MPH, Dedamir, or Levemir, and Glargine. So we have three basal insulins to choose from to imitate the basal insulin work the pancreas would do. So whenever I look at blood sugars, I'm like, what are we missing from this picture? Is it basal insulin or bolus insulin? And how can we imitate the work of the pancreas? So just to go over this a little bit more, bolus insulin lowers after meal glucose levels. So I kind of think of the bolus insulin as the rabbit. It gets in there, does its job, it hops back out. Basal insulin controls glucose between meals and through the night. It's intermediate acting MPH, which you take twice a day, or the long acting, which you can take once a day. Some people actually do need Levemir twice a day. And a lot of times I'll see patients with Lantus twice a day. It's really not that necessary. Most of the time we can control it on a once-a-day injection because it has a 24-hour profile. So I'm always trying to see how can we give the person the least amount of injections to improve glucose outcomes. So if the bolus is the rabbit, the basal is the turtle. And no particular rush to get started, hangs out for a long time, and then makes its way back out again. And so these are our insulin action teams. Despite the valiant efforts of the research group, the insulin suppository still had one major problem. So why am I showing this picture? Well, because we've been trying to think of a different way to give insulin besides injections for a long time. And it is true that we do now have an approved inhaled insulin called Afrezza. Now you may ask me, is Afrezza going to be on the exam? Probably not. I would, you know, say with 100% surety, no, because it was just approved. And so it will probably appear on next year's exam or maybe even in the future. It takes them a while to incorporate new medications. But I just wanted to share for your own information a little bit about Afrezza because I think it's important. This was approved and it was only studied in adults over the age of 18, so not peds, but the FDA is asking them to go ahead and continue studying in kids as part of their post-marketing responsibilities. Not indicated while pregnant or breastfeeding. And you can see the Afrezza is here. It has a very fast peak. It gets in really quickly. It's inhaled into the alveoli of the lungs, and then it's absorbed very quickly in the alveoli because there's a lower pH. It activates this technosphere to be released. We'll talk about it more in a minute, but I just wanted to kind of show you where it fits in the scheme of things. It's a bolus insulin, and all of these are bolus insulins. And you can see regular still appears in the bolus insulin category. Regular insulin is not used that much anymore, but I certainly think it has its place. Regular insulin is as effective as these other insulins on lowering blood sugar. The main problem with regular insulin is that it takes 30 minutes to start working. And so you have to give it 30 minutes before a meal, which is really cumbersome for a lot of our patients. But you can see it has a little bit longer tail. It lasts for 2 to 4 hours. Well, its peak action is 2 to 4 hours, and it lasts for up to 6 hours, where these newer analogs have a shorter peak action, and so they don't stay around as long. But anyways, each of these insulin has their, you know, benefits and their disadvantages. But I would just say from a cost perspective, which we'll show you in a minute, regular insulin is most affordable. But the thing I do want to point out about bolus insulins is that they should comprise half your daily dose. So if somebody's on 60 units of insulin a day, about 30 units, half of that, should be bolus. And you always want to look at the ratio from bolus to basal. Half of their insulin dose should be bolus, and we'll talk about that more when we do formulas. I do want to spend a minute on inhaled insulin. It is FDA approved, and Sanofi Aventis has purchased it. When I talk to the reps, they're thinking maybe early 2015 they'll have it available. It's regular human insulin and formed into powder through Technosphere technology. And when I was reading papers on it, you'll see it referred to as T1, Technosphere insulin. It's going to be about $300 a month, and it is dosed in a similar fashion, one-to-one ratio, just like regular insulin. But it only comes in two dose units, 4 units and 8 units. 4 units or 8 units are the only dosing units that we have available. And the other thing, since it is inhaled into the alveoli, we have to do a lung function test before we start. And it's FEV1 is a forced expiratory volume, so you can use an incentive spirometer to evaluate this in the office. It certainly is not indicated for patients with chronic lung issues, asthma, COPD, history of lung cancer, smokers, and it can cause acute bronchospasm. There's a black box warning on that. Here's side effects: hypoglycemia, sore throat, and cough, but there is less weight gain and less hypoglycemia than injected insulin. Here's the device. I don't know if you saw the old Exubra device. It was 20 times bigger than this. I mean, it was very large and cumbersome. This is like a little whistle, and all you do is you open this mouthpiece, and you put the cartridge of insulin in right here, close it, and then you inhale it. And here's how you inhale. You first you exhale, put the inhaler in the mouth, tilt the inhaler down a little bit, and take a deep breath and hold it for as long as comfortable. And then after you're done, you remove cartridge and replace cover. So really easy to do, and they've color-coded it so that the blue is 4 units, the blue cartridge, and the green is 8 units, and so people can easily identify how much insulin they're taking. So just, I'm sure you're thinking, well, what if my patient's on 5 units of regular insulin before breakfast, and they're on 5 units of regular insulin before breakfast and dinner and 10 units of Detemir? Well, this is just a bolus insulin, so they still would need to take their Detemir, but how do we imitate 5 units if there's only 4 or 8? So you'd have to figure out what is best for your patient. Like if the patient is type 1, I would say do the 4 units and see how it works because they're more insulin sensitive. But if they're type 2, they have a little bit more ability to manage more insulin, so maybe we go for the 8 units, the 2 fours. But what if their blood glucose before the meal is 67? We probably give them less. But what if their blood glucose before the meal is 170? We probably give them the 8 units. So this dosing strategy will take a lot of problem solving with the educator, with the patient, to figure out what's number one, always, always, always safe for that patient, is a big deal. Okay, let's keep going because that's not on the exam, but I think it's so important because as diabetes educators, patients are going to be asking you about inhaled insulin. And on our resource page, I do have articles on inhaled insulin that you could take a look at. So bolus insulin summary, we have regular Novolog, Humalog, Apidra, we have Afrezza, the inhaled, starts working fast, gets out fast. How do we tell how well it's working? Well, we can look at the post-meal blood sugar or the before next meal pre-blood sugar. So if I take my bolus of lisinopril before breakfast, I could check 2 hours after the meal to see how well I'm doing, or I could check before the next meal to see how well that bolus worked. We'll talk about that more in a minute. Should be about half the daily dose, and bolus insulin covers food or hyperglycemia. Now, generally speaking, people will ask me, well, how much does 1 unit cover? And 1 unit covers about 10 to 15 grams of carb. And how do patients know how much works for them? It's trial and error. There's formulas we use for our type 1s, but I'm not going to get into that right now. But that's kind of more advanced level. But for regular patients on insulin, our type 1s or type 2s, we just start here with 15 grams of carbohydrate if they're real sensitive. Or they're real more insulin resistant, we might say 1 unit to cover 10 grams of carbohydrate. And then as patients become more sophisticated, we can intensify and do more intense problem solving with them around this. The other thing is 1 unit lowers blood glucose 30 to 50 points. And I'll tell you, this is called insulin sensitivity, but it's really relative to body weight. If I'm heavy, One unit will drop me 30 points. If I'm very lean, one unit drops me 50 points. So the heavier you are, the more insulin resistant, the leaner you are, the more insulin sensitive you are. So very lean patients need a lot less insulin. As a matter of fact, if you walked into a lean patient's room with 10 units of regular insulin or 10 units of Apidra, they're probably going to point you out in a different direction. It's too much insulin. But if you walked into a heavy person's room with, you know, 2 units of regular insulin, they might laugh and say, that's not going to touch me. So we always listen to what our patients tell us. Too much, too little. They've been living with their diabetes a long time. They really know what's going to work for them. We're going to go over some more formulas that help us figure out how much insulin a person needs. But let's take a look at this poll question 2. Mary takes 4 units of Lispro before breakfast. Which blood glucose result reflects that this was the right dose for her? So she takes this 4 units of Humalog before breakfast. Which blood glucose reflects that that was the right dose? Okay. So take a few more seconds. Okay, just take your best guess, even if you're not sure. Let me go ahead and close this poll and go over the right answer. So is it A, before breakfast, blood glucose of 97, or B, 1 hour post-meal breakfast of 153, or C, before lunch, blood glucose of 69, or D, 2 hour post-meal breakfast of 183? So I'm going to go ahead and close this, and let's just go over it together. So if you didn't know the answer for this, you know, that's totally okay. This is just information gathering for you as far as what do you need to study more. So the main question I'm trying to get at, or the main thought, is what is the goal for blood sugars? And the goal for blood sugar that I'm trying to get at here is that 1 to 2 hours after a meal, the blood sugar should be less than 180. Or if we check the blood sugar before the next meal, it should be 70 to 130. So this is ultimately what this question is trying to get at. What are the targets for blood sugar? So she took her 4 units of Lispro before breakfast. Which blood sugar would reflect that that was the right dose? So it wouldn't be the blood glucose of 97 before breakfast, because that blood sugar would reflect what happened the night before with the basal insulin. The before breakfast blood sugar reflects what happened the night before. Was the basal insulin enough, or whatever medication they're on in the evening? Did it work? So that's not the right answer. That's not what we're looking for. Now let's take a look at 2. 61% of you chose this. 1 hour post-breakfast blood glucose of 153. So we know the standards say when you check the blood sugar after breakfast, after a meal, it should be, you know, less than 180. So this does meet that criteria. 1 hour after meal, it's less than 180. So that looks like the right answer. Let's keep going. Some of you chose this, before blood glucose, blood sugar is 69. So the target for before lunch is 70 to 130. She's 69. So actually, this tells us this is too much insulin based on what she ate. So that is not the right answer either. This blood glucose is below target. And then the 2 hour post breakfast, 21% of you chose that. So 2 hour post meal blood sugar less than 180. This is 183. So the right answer is B, when 61% of you chose that. So great job, everybody. 1 hour post meal blood sugar of 153. So if you have any questions about this, you can always, you know, review this and look at the goals. And also we have the online course that goes over insulin therapy. You can listen to this again. So this is just it was test taking practice, a lot of it too. So, you know, I put a lot of test questions on your online course. I put 14, and it has a lot about basal bolus and pattern management, so you feel like you can get a lot of practice with this type of question. Okay, so here's, I'm answering this again. How is the effectiveness of bolus insulin determined? 2 hour post-meal if you can get it, and the 1 to 2 hour post-meal goal is less than 180, or before next meal blood glucose where the goal is 70 to 130. So those are definitely goals you want to keep in mind. All right, let's take a look at this. So this is one of my favorite slides ever because it tells us why sliding scale doesn't work. This patient is on a bolus insulin sliding scale. It starts at 150. She takes 2 units for every 50 above 150. So this scale is what I call the 2, 4, 6, 8, what don't we appreciate? It starts at 150 to 199, you get 2 units. You know, 200 to 250, you get 4, and so forth. 251 to 300, you get 6. So this scale is just a standard scale, and I'm sure many of you have seen this in the real world, and you'll just take a look at this together, and we'll see why this doesn't work at all. And so when a patient comes in, this could be outpatient or inpatient, whatever, and this R stands for regular, her blood sugar is 94. Well, based on this scale of 94, she gets no insulin because her blood sugar is at target. It's below 150. And so if she takes no insulin, but she eats 45 grams of carbohydrate, what's going to happen to her blood sugars? It's going to go up. You see, if you're thinking like a pancreas, you would know when that blood sugar is 94, you need some insulin to cover the carbs. If she eats 45 grams of carb and you take about 1 unit for every 15, we know she'll need about 3 units of insulin to cover that carb she ate, but she got none. So even if I never looked at this next number, I know she went up at lunch, and sure enough, before lunch, her blood sugar is 212. Now the goal for before lunch is 70 to 130. She's 212. It's way above our target. But the scale called for 4 units of regular insulin. Well, it was kind of lucky that she took 4 units because she had 45 grams of carbohydrate. And if she takes 1 unit for every 15 grams, she needs 3 plus an additional to cover hyperglycemia. Let's see what her blood sugar did before dinner. Well, our target before dinner is 70 to 130. We got close, 148, but still it's not right because it's supposed to be less than 130 before meals. So now we're at 148, and because it's less than the scale, where the scale starts at 150, no insulin is given. We give no insulin, and now look at that nighttime blood sugar, 254. What is the target for before you go to bed? Well, if you're on insulin, the target before you go to bed is 110 to 180. She's 254, so again, above target. Now, this is a serious situation. They're going to give her 6 units of regular before she puts her head on the pillow, and this is not a good idea. What if this patient is, let's just put her at home. What if she's at home and on this scale? She gives herself 6 units of regular. What is she at risk for? Severe low blood sugar. And so whenever I meet with patients, of course, you know, I say, we really should not be giving regular insulin at bedtime because it can make your blood sugars go too low. Where does she need this regular insulin? She needs it here before dinner. If we would have just given her 4 units to cover her 60 grams of carbohydrate, her blood sugar at bedtime would have been right on. So this is why sliding scales don't work. They chase after blood sugars. But anyways, let's see what happened now. We gave 6 units of regular at bedtime. Her morning blood sugar is 243. Wow, that's way above target. Our target in the morning is 70 to 130. She's 243. So what caused that? Well, there could be 2 things. Number one, she might have got low during the night. Maybe she went down to 60. Maybe she went down to 50. And she released a lot of counter-regulatory hormones like glucagon, epinephrine, that raised her blood sugar. Fancy term for that is Somogyi effect. So she went low, she had rebound hyperglycemia, she released stress hormones to get her blood sugars up, and she woke up at a 243. That could have happened. But what is the other thing that might have be wrong here? What insulin is she missing? If you were thinking like a pancreas, what insulin should she be getting that she is not? You are right. There is no basal insulin. There's no Lantus. There's no MPH, there's no Dedamir, there's nothing. So maybe she's just running out of insulin at night and her liver is just releasing all kinds of glycogen stores and just, you know, having, maybe the liver is partying all night and just saying, yoo-hoo, I'm going to release a lot of glucose. That could be happening. And she wakes up high. And so let's just continue with this day. And it's not a good way to wake up in the morning at 2:43. It's too high. It's above target. 70 to 130 is a target. And if you wake up at 2:43, it's really hard to get your blood sugars to target during the day. I just want to point out a few things. She's taking three and four injections a day. And how many times are her blood sugars in target? She's giving herself three to four injections based on the sliding scale. She's checking her blood sugars four times a day. And yet, there's only one blood sugar that's in target, the first one. Look here. She took 4 units of regular at bedtime. She went down to 66 in the morning. That's dangerous. We don't want anybody waking up below 70 in the morning. So this scale doesn't match the person. This scale doesn't think like a pancreas. This scale is just a formula that is not specific to anybody, individualized to anybody, and it can actually be pretty dangerous. And so this is why insulin sliding scale doesn't work. So what we would think about doing instead of just, you know, signing insulin based on blood sugar at that moment is think about how much is she eating? How much insulin does she need on a daily basis? And what about the basal insulin? So let's keep going so we can figure out different ways to provide insulin therapy that's more meaningful and matches the patient. And so that's bolus insulin, should be half the total daily dose. Here's basal insulin, should be the other half. Now you can see this is all important to know. So for the exam, you want to memorize these different insulins, what they're called, what their action and duration time is. You want to be really familiar which ones are basal, which ones are bolus, because they're going to ask you to apply this information in different scenarios. So we have the MPH, which lasts for a half a day. You have to take it twice daily to work. And we have the longer actings that are peakless. These are the newer analogs, and they last for a day. Now, when we say they last for a day, everybody's different. Some people have different metabolism, different body heat. They use insulin differently. It's absorbed differently. It depends where they inject it. So these are just rough estimates, but they kind of give us a general idea. Of course, we adjust these based on the patient's blood glucose response. How do we determine how well basal insulin is working? We look at the fasting. This is so important. Circle this, put a star, jump off, you know, just make it stand out in some way. The fasting blood glucose reflects the efficacy of basal insulin. So I'm just saying the same thing in a lot of different ways. So you want to know which are the basals, and you want to know basal insulin covers in between meals through the night. Starts working slow, stays in long. It's the turtle. Let's take a look at this patient. He's type 2. He's 60 kilograms. He's on basal insulin only. So I see this a lot in real life. So I try and put a lot of real life situations in here for you, but also situations that you might see on the exam. Anyways, his A1C is 8.9. Is that at target? No, we want the A1C less than 7. And this is after 3 months of basal therapy. So it is true. What we'll say is when patients have type 2 diabetes, start them on metformin. We might start them on basal insulin. Those are two options for us. We want to get that fasting blood sugar down. So you can see we started off with 10 units of Lantus at month 1, and his morning blood sugar went from 178 to 166, so there's some improvement. We cranked it up to 20 units of Lantus, and this is not the educator per se. This is the provider, and we're consulting with the patient, of course. So it's up to 20 units of Lantus, and you can see the blood sugar fasting 143, so it's improving, but we're at 30 units of Lantus now, and probably we're going to get to target of less than 130. But sure, we've gotten that morning blood sugar down, but what about the A1C? It's 8.9. And look at the bedtime blood sugar. What's the target for bedtime? Less than 180, 110 to 180. We are never making that target. And I see this a lot where patients are on basal insulin only, and they're getting their blood sugars are great in the morning, they're at target, but the rest of the day they're running high. So is this thinking like a pancreas? No, it's not. This is just basal insulin, so that doesn't match either. And so we need to make sure we use a combination of both for a lot of our patients. Let's take a look at poll question 3. Calvin takes 5 units of regular insulin at dinner and 18 units of MPH at night. His morning blood glucose range from 63 272. What is the best action? So let me go ahead and launch this for you all. Should we A, decrease the regular insulin to 4 units? B, encourage them to eat a bedtime snack? Should we C, decrease MPH insulin at bedtime? Or D, have him check a 2 a.m. blood glucose? All right. And so again, I'm using this word best in my question. So you want to figure out what is the best thing we should do to help this patient. Okay, we'll take a few more seconds. Okay, I'm going to go ahead and close this poll. Thank you so much, everyone. So he takes 5 units of regular at dinner. What blood sugar is that going to affect? The 5 units regular at dinner affects his bedtime blood sugar. And the 18 units of MPH at night affects his morning blood sugar. So that's the first thing we need to think through in our head. And then we're going to look at this morning blood glucose, 63 to 72. And then we have to think, what is the morning target? The morning target is 70 to 130. But a lot of times this patient is going too low in the morning, because if he's running 63, 64, 65, that's definitely too low. So safety is always really big. We want to get that morning blood sugar above 70. And so one more time. The 5 units of regular at dinner affects bedtime blood sugar. It's out of your system in 5-6 hours. The 18 units of MPH at night affects his morning blood sugar. So let's take a look. A, would you decrease the dinner regular to 4 units? Actually, that wouldn't help, because that insulin at dinner just affects the bedtime blood sugar. So that wouldn't help get that morning up. So that is not the right answer. And B, nobody chose that. Great. Thank you. C, 80% of you chose that, and that actually is the right answer. We want to decrease the MPH at night to help bring down, you want to decrease the MPH at night to help prevent low blood sugars from happening in the morning. That is exactly the right answer. We could have him check a 2 a.m. blood glucose, but why? Because we know he's running low. We have good data. And so that wouldn't help us to get more information and make a better decision. We know that MPH at night affects morning blood sugar. Morning blood sugar is too low. Decrease MPH at night. All right. Thanks, everyone. Let's keep going. I'm glad we're doing these practice questions, because it gives you lots of opportunity to, you know, to evaluate what you're really great at, what your knowledge is, where it's strong, and what to study more. Okay, this is from Diabetes Care 2009. This probably won't be on the exam. I'll just spend a few minutes on it. But I have found this a really nice framework for my practice, especially for patients with type 2. This is designed for type 2 patients starting on insulin. So it says start with bedtime intermediate acting insulin. You could do it bedtime or morning long-acting insulin. And generally, we start with about 10 units, and this is a number you're going to see over and over again, or 0.2 units of insulin per kilogram. If you're having a hard time seeing this, I did put this article on your resource list. You can download it, and it's a big version of it you can print out. Basal insulin, this is a number you're going to see over and over again. I just said that. I'm going to repeat it, though. 0.2 units of insulin per kilogram for basal. And then we take that fasting blood sugar daily, and we increase by 2 to 3 units every day until fastings are in target, 70 to 130. We can increase more aggressively every 4 units every 3 days if that blood sugar is really high. So as a diabetes educator, I'm not a nurse practitioner. I can't do this without a physician's approval. So if I'm working with patients on their insulin, I will be in constant communication with the provider, making sure that, you know, this is okay and that this is working, for, you know, and are we okay adjusting the insulin and so forth. But I want to point out something really important to the left here. If hypoglycemia occurs or fasting blood sugar is less than 70, reduce bedtime dose of basal by 4 units or 10%, whatever is greater. This is a critical piece of information for our practice and for the exam. If morning sugar is too low, decrease bedtime dose by 4 units or 10%. But just in general, we've got to decrease that basal insulin. But look what it says over here. If A1C is more than 7% after 2 to 3 months, and the fasting is in target, we need to add bolus insulin. Depending on blood glucose result at second injection as below, can usually begin with 4 units and adjust by 2 units every 3 days. So look at this. If pre-lunch blood sugar is out of range, you would add rapid acting insulin when? At breakfast. Exactly. If dinner's too high, you would add bolus insulin at lunch. If bedtime is too high, we add rapid acting insulin at dinner. And look what they say. Start with about 4 units. Isn't that interesting? So I just think this is a really nice algorithm, and I'm going to show you another algorithm in a minute. But if you have patients on basal insulin and you want to add bolus, I would add bolus to the blood sugar that's the highest to get that number to target. You could start there and then add other bolus insulins on. Okay, let's talk about combination insulin. So combination insulin is premixed insulin, and it comes in a bottle or a pen, premixed. You need to know what this number means is that this first number represents percentage of basal. So if it says 75-25, it's 75% NPL. So you may say, hey, what is NPL? Actually, NPL is long-acting lispro. It's intermediate-acting lispro. It lasts for half a day. So they had to reformulate it to make this an intermediate-acting insulin. So these premix insulins usually are given twice a day, before breakfast and before dinner. 50-50 is 50% NPL, or 50% intermediate, 50% bolus, so and so forth. 70-30 is 70% NPH, 30% regular. They last for half a day. Generally, you need to give them twice a day, before breakfast, before dinner. The problem with these is they're pre-mixed, so it's hard to fine-tune therapy. But the great thing is that for my patients who are running in the 300s, they just need insulin. It's an easy getting started insulin. You just take it twice a day, and patients can really succeed with it. So let's just go over this. If we're going to give a mix of 70-30, which is basal plus bolus, when does the AM basal, what blood sugar does it affect? It affects before dinner. So when we check that before dinner, it's a reflection of that morning basal or intermediate. The AM bolus insulin is reflected in pre-lunch blood sugar. So if I'm giving lispro in the morning, that is reflected in my pre-lunch blood sugar. The nighttime basal, if I get that 70-30 before dinner time, the long-acting or intermediate-acting insulin that's a part of that would be reflected in my before breakfast blood sugar. And in that 70-30 mixture, the 30% bolus, that would be reflected in my bedtime blood sugar. So using that information, let's go ahead and take a look at this pattern. So a patient's come in to see us and they bring their logbook, and you look at this logbook, and right away we're thinking about what patterns emerge. And when we look for patterns, it's always most important to consider safety. Safety is number one. How do we help keep our patients from getting too low of blood sugar? So go ahead and take a look at this for a minute and think about, what do we need to change to make sure this patient is safe? All right. The first thing I notice here is this morning blood sugar. The target in the morning is 70 to 130. We have a 73, we have this weird thing, it's 162, but if we look back the night before was 87, so they could have got some real low and had some rebound here, I'm not sure. Here's a 71, here's a 68. My target for before breakfast is 70 to 130, and I can see I'm steadily moving toward hypoglycemia. And so now I have to think, what insulin is affecting that morning blood sugar? I'm taking 20 units of 70-30 before breakfast and 20 units before dinner. I broke it out here for you to say, of that 20 units, if you look at the ratio, 70% is basal, which equals 14 units. 30% is bolus, which equals 6. So I know it's this 14 units of basal that's making that morning blood sugar go too low. Let's just take a look at the bedtime blood sugar. Bedtime target less than 180, more than 110. Wow, we're looking really good here. So, you know, this number is a little bit low sometimes because I said I like it more than 110. So we know this is too much insulin before dinner. 20 units is too much. We're getting a little bit lower than our comfort zone at bedtime, and we're definitely too low in the morning. So what do we need to do? We need to decrease the 70-30 before dinner. So they may ask, they may give you a situation like this and give you four choices. What should you do? Number one thing we should do here is decrease the 70-30. It's at 20. Let's go to 16. Let's be aggressive. Well, you know, so you have to decrease it. That's obviously the goal. How much you decrease it is up to you and the patient and your negotiation, safety. Do they live alone? You know, there's a lot of negotiations involved, but I always go for safety. So I would say, let's go to 16, see what happens. Yeah, his bedtime is going to bump up a little bit, but we have room to bump up. I want that breakfast running, you know, above 70 consistently. Let's just take a look at lunch. The goal before lunch is 70 to 130. We're a little bit above target, but we could definitely talk here about what he's eating at breakfast. I think because he's so, like, on the verge of low at breakfast, he's probably eating a lot of carbs to cover. And so the rest of this, we're going to let it sit. We're going to reduce it to 16 units, let it sit for a few days, see how the patient does. Okay, let's keep going. We have a 70-year-old. He weighs 100 kilograms. He smokes. His A1C is above target. His blood glucose for the past few weeks, very high, 400 to 500. He's on insulin, only Lantus, Solostar, 100 units at bedtime. That's the only insulin he's on, but he's on metformin and Invokana. This is a true story that would happen in my clinic. The patient told me, I can't afford insulin pen. I'm almost out. This provider gave me samples. Once I'm out of insulin pens, I have no more insulin. And, of course, I'm panicking because I know this gentleman is at very high risk for a heart attack or a stroke. So I did write a whole article on this topic, on medications on a budget, and it's a newsletter. I'll put the link for that in your resource list. But I did put also here, how can we help make this affordable for our patients? And I just did a random analysis of pharmacies in my area to see how much insulin's cost. And I do want to say Walmart has the most affordable insulin. It's Novolin insulin, but they call it Relyon brand, Relyon insulin, R-E-L-I-O-N. $25 for a vial of regular, MPH, or 70-30. Look at these other pharmacies, Walgreens and Costco's, how much it costs a bottle? $100. So if I'm cash pay, if I'm in the donut hole, if I'm working poor and I don't have insurance, this is the brand for me. I have really helped so many patients be able to afford this by getting them on this more affordable brand. Look at the Humalog Novolog Apedra, $200 a bottle. Levemir, very expensive, you know, basal insulin, Lantus, $200. So this is what these cost if you're cash pay. And so I just want you to be aware that if you're working with patients who don't have good insurance, this is an issue. Okay, I'm going to ask you all to do a little bit of math now. Quick calculation, and I give you a hint here. One vial of insulin holds 1,000 units. So a patient takes 30 units of Humalog at breakfast and dinner, 20 units of Humalog at lunch and in between breakfast and lunch. If the blood glucose is over 200, here's their A1C. So my question for you is, how many insulin vials would this patient use a month? I'm going to go ahead and launch that for you. Okay, keep voting. So there is some math involved here. I hear you. So you want to think, you want to add up how much insulin could this patient potentially use a month at the worst case scenario, that they take it always as indicated here, every day. How much would they need? Okay. I'm going to go ahead and close this poll. And let's just talk about it a little bit. So you might want to ask me, are they going to have questions like this on the exam? Well, not exactly like this, but they will want, they might ask you how many insulin vials will a patient need a month, and they would give you a similar situation like this. So let's just do this math together. So they take 30 units of Humalog at breakfast and dinner, that equals 60 units. And then they take 20 units in between breakfast and lunch, an additional 20 units at lunch if the blood sugar is over 200. So potentially, they could take 20 units more at lunch and 20 units more between breakfast and lunch. So that's another 40 units. So they take 60 units a day, plus they might take another 40 units, which equals 100 units. So that's 100 units a day. And we know there's 1,000 units in an insulin vial. So 1,000 divided by 100, it means that one vial would last 10 days. And then if one vial lasts 10 days, you would need 3 vials a month for this patient. 3 vials a month because of the way they're dosing their insulin. So I hope that made sense to you. So the correct answer, and 40% of you got it right, is 3 vials a month. And that's, you know what, that's good to know for our patients, because patients are on lots of insulin these days. How much will they need? Make sure they have adequate supply of insulin and make sure they're not getting too much insulin, because that can go bad over time. So you want to make sure they have the right prescription for what their needs are. Okay, let's keep going. I like this slide a lot because it looks at insulin dosing for type 1 and type 2. So you can see with type 1 diabetes, and this is units of insulin per kilogram per day. So when we talk about insulin dosing, we always talk about it in units of insulin per kilogram per day. So, you know, there's for every 1 pound, it's 2.2 kilograms. So you have to do some conversion in your head. But anyways, for type 1 diabetes, you could see they need about 0.25 to 1 unit of insulin per kilogram per day. Why? Type 1s are not insulin resistant. They're insulin sensitive. They suck up insulin. They don't push it away. They use everything they get. So type 1s are much more fine-tuning involved in their insulin dosing. They just utilize what they get, and it's relative to body weight, very relative to body weight. But look at our type 2s. They can use anywhere from 0.5 to 2.25 units of insulin per kilogram per day. Why? They use more because type 2s have more insulin resistance because of the visceral adiposity. So because type 2s are more insulin resistant, they need more insulin than what their body weight might seem to require. So they'll need enough to cover their body weight, plus many times a little bit more. And so they're a little bit harder to fine-tune. You know, you can adjust them 4 units and maybe not even see a response because of that insulin resistance. Others are very super insulin resistant, and they need amazingly high doses. But I do want to talk about U500 for a few minutes, because many, as our population gets heavier and gains weight, many of our patients are requiring more than 200 units a day of insulin. And when they require more than 200 units a day, that's 2 full insulin syringes a day. It can start becoming problematic because the patients have a psychological resistance. They don't like filling up their syringe more than one time. They have to do it twice. It's really difficult psychologically. And then going beyond 100, what are you going to do? You know, you're going to take 120, 2 different shots. And so we definitely want to consider U500. So let me talk about what is U500. U500, instead of giving 100 units per mil, it gives 500 units per mil. It's 5 times the potency of U100. And so 1 unit in a U100 syringe of U500 equals 5 units. It's 5 times as potent. If I was to give 5 units of U500, That would be 25 units of the U100. I know it's confusing wording, so I'm trying to make it as simple as possible, but it's just five times as strong. The great thing about U500 is that it has basal and bolus properties. If I take U500, I don't need to take any other insulin. It's because of the way it's formulated, it starts working right away and has a long tail. So what I would do as far as dosing is take my total daily needs and split into two doses, 60% in the morning, 40% in the PM. It comes in a 20 milliliter vial. Each milliliter is 500 units. So there's 10,000 units per vial. Look how much they cost, $400. But if you do a cost analysis for patients who are taking that much insulin, it turns out to be a similar cost expense. Because now they only need one insulin, they take it twice a day, and it's a lot more concentrated. But of course, as you can imagine, this needs careful monitoring and education. Once you get a patient started on it, it's pretty safe. It's when they have to interact with a hospital or there's an emergency, that's where the problems can start. So hospitals are very cautious about U500, and they often dose it in a tuberculin syringe. Now, why would they dose it in a tuberculin syringe? Because tuberculin syringe is volume-based, so they feel like there's less room for error. A U100 syringe, they feel there's more potential for error because people think then, oh, it's U100, when it's really a five times concentrated dose. So you can see here the relationship between, if we have 75 units of U500, you would pull up 15 units in a U100 syringe. So 15 units of U500 equals 75 units of insulin. Or you could use a tuberculin syringe and base it on volume. And so many times if there's U500 in the hospital setting, the pharmacist will draw it up just for safety issues in that TB syringe. So if you draw up U500 in a U100 syringe, one unit would actually equal 5 units of insulin. 3 units would equal 15. What would 6 units equal? Right, you just times it times 5 to get 30. And so I did this little chart here, so I filled in the blanks here. If you're taking actual units or 60, you would pull up 12 units in a U100 syringe of the U500. 12 units would equal 60 actual dose. And so do I think this is going to appear on the exam? I don't know. It might, because U500 is being used more frequently. But I did put a lot of articles in your resource page on U500 that will give you some more information about it, how to utilize it, how other institutions are utilizing it. But certainly, we're always aware of safety and making sure that it's safe for patients in whatever setting they're at. Let's talk a little bit more about pattern management. And so when we think about pattern management, we want to identify personal goals of the patient. So we're not just going to say, you need to get your blood sugar 70 to 130 before meals and less than 180 after meals. No, we personalize it. What if a patient's running 400? I may just say the first goal is to get you less than 300, right? So we're going to adjust and identify goals based on their willingness to check their blood sugar, their willingness to keep a log, what is their support, social provider support. So we consider all of this when we're helping patients get their insulin dose to where it needs to be. But definitely when we help with pattern management, hypoglycemia is the first thing we consider. We want them to be safe. So we're going to fix that first, and then we move on to hyperglycemia. And of course, I am talking about insulin on this lecture, but on the back of my mind and heart is always medications, exercise, what are they eating, what's their activity level. That's an integral part of pattern adjustment. And we'll be talking more about oral medications next time. In the last class, we'll be talking about nutrition. But certainly as we go through these, that's always foremost in my mind, what's going on in that person's lifestyle, which is very, very important. But let's just take a look at this. We have a new type 2. He's on Lantus every night, 10 units. What patterns do you see, and what questions would you ask? All right, so let's just think about low. Are we worried about low blood sugar? Yeah, he's on insulin. Low blood sugar could be a consequence of insulin. But really, his blood sugars are are in target range. They're never running below 70. So we know he's not getting too much insulin. So now let's look at hyperglycemia. When he's taking 10 units of Lantus at night, we're going to look at his morning blood sugars. The target for morning is 70 to 130. He's above target. So we know this is not enough Lantus, that he probably needs to increase it by a few units to get his blood sugar to target in the morning. But the other thing I'm wondering is, why is his dinner time, his dinner time blood sugar is on target, right, 70 to 130. But look at his bedtime. The target's less than 180. So definitely above target there. And what could we do? Well, this will be a time I would talk about meals. How much carbohydrate are you eating at dinner time? You know, I'm interested that your blood sugars are running above 180 at bedtime. That's oftentimes a reflection of what you ate at dinner. Let's take a look at your meal plan at dinner. Okay, that's one approach. The other approach is we could say, hey, I noticed that your bedtime blood sugars are above target. So you'll notice when I talk to patients, I never say the word high. I don't go, oh my gosh, your blood sugars are so high. Because when I use that word, they feel like failures. So I try and use non-judgmental words like above target, below target. Because truly, when their blood sugars are above target, we need to figure out a solution. And there's three things usually that are affecting that blood sugar: with the food, medication, activity. So one of those three needs to be tweaked a little bit. So getting back to my original statement here, I was saying maybe look at carbs at dinner, but also would you be willing to go for a walk after dinner? Maybe a 10-minute walk would really help get these blood sugars down and we're in at target range. It would get them in target range again. So we're going to do some negotiations. So certainly we could increase insulin, but I'm wondering first if there's other lifestyle things that they could do to get blood sugar to target range. So I'm going to talk about food and I'm going to talk about activity because insulin is a growth hormone. So I'm always saying let's use other strategies first before just jumping on increasing insulin if they're just at the cusp like he is here. The other question I want to ask you is this guy on metformin? So when I look at this, I would think, wow, he could really benefit from some metformin too to help lower the blood sugar in the background and support the work of the Lantus insulin. So that would be another question. And then lastly, is he checking his blood sugars enough? He's checking three times a day. He's rotating times. Absolutely. So when this gentleman walks in, we're going to say to him, I am so impressed that you're checking your blood sugar three times a day. You're writing it down. You're keeping a logbook. This is excellent. We always want to acknowledge the work of our patients. So to answer our question, what are we going to do in this situation? We're going to look at carbs, exercise, and then we might need to make some insulin adjustments in the future. But let's take a look at this guy. Type 2, glyburide, 10 milligrams in the morning. He's on Dadamir, 12 units at bedtime. So glyburide, we want to think, what is glyburide? It's a sulfonylurea. And on the exam, they will give you the trade and the generic name together, unlike what I've done. I haven't done that consistently for these case studies, but on the exam, they will do that. Okay. What I first want you to do is doing pattern management. Where are you worried about his blood sugars? What time of day? Absolutely. We're worried about dinner time. The goal for before dinner is 70 to 130. He's really having trouble keeping that. Sorry about that, you guys. He's really having trouble keeping that target range. He's going below. He had 181. So what is the culprit here? Is it the Dadamir, 12 units at night, or is it the glyburide, 10 milligrams in the morning, that's making his blood sugar go too low? You're right. It's not the Dadamir, because the Dadamir is running out. You know, it's really losing its efficacy. It's on the waxing and waning by dinner time. It lasts maybe 20 hours. So that's not the culprit here. The culprit is the glyburide. And glyburide, I just read a great article on it, really can cause severe hypoglycemia. So it's the 10 milligrams of glyburide in the morning that's making this dinner go too low. So what is our action step here? You could say to the patient, eat more at lunch or have a snack between lunch and dinner. That's not the right answer, because they're going to gain weight if they do that. And we never want to feed the medication. We want to cut back. So we're going to cut back on the glyburide. We're going to call the provider and say, hey, can we cut the glyburide dose in half? That would definitely be something we need to do urgently. So for this pattern, we want to fix low first, and then we'll let that sit for a few days, and then we'll start working on these high blood sugars. The breakfast, the target 70 to 130, certainly above that. So we may actually end up in the future adjusting the Dedimer to get that morning down. But I never make any adjustments if I'm working on hypoglycemia. I just fix hypoglycemia, let it sit for a few days, and then we can start adjusting the other medications to reach target. Okay, let's take a look at this guy. Basal bolus, what adjustment? The patient weighs 80 kilograms. So I'm just going to be quiet again for a moment and tell me, and you could just look and see for yourself, what blood sugars are you worried about? What time of day is your most worrisome? Okay. Well, I agree with all of you. It's this morning blood sugar. The target for the morning is 70 to 130. And this patient is running, you know, only one time. Well, a few times they're running a little bit higher than that, but I'm very concerned about this low blood sugar. And whose fault is that? Which insulin is causing these morning blood sugars to go too low? You're right. It's the Dedimer. It's too much Dedimer at 22 units. And so what would you all decrease it to? We're going to decrease it 10% or 4 units, whatever greater. So we're going to decrease this to 18 units. We want to always be safe. So we'll decrease the Dedimer. This will get that morning blood sugar up. But now let's just keep looking through the rest of the day. Lunch is at target, 70 to 130. Is dinner at target, 70 to 130? No, it's above target. So another problem area. But I want you to look at this differently now. He's on 7 of H at breakfast, and H stands for Humalog, 5 of Humalog at lunch, 8 of Humalog at dinner. And so I asked the patient, it's a true story, where did you get this dose? And he's like, I made it up. So a lot of our patients do that. They saw an endocrinologist or a provider who started them on a dose, and then they adjusted it over time. So I want to give you a formula to help figure out what would be the right dose for this patient based on what they present with. And it's called the 50-50 rule. And they might talk about the 50-50 rule on the exam. They may not have you actually calculate anything, but you want to be familiar with it. The 50-50 rule says patients need about 0.5 to 1 units of insulin per kilogram per day, like we had discussed earlier. Half of that basal, half of that bolus. So let's look at the formula. Example, if you weigh 50 kilograms, you would say 50 times 0.5, we always start most conservative, is 25 units of insulin a day. You divide that in half. So half is basal, which is 13, and the other half is bolus, which is 12. And then you divide this 12 into 3 meals. So 12 divided by 3 meals is 4 units at every meal. And so this is a very typical, we've seen this before in that other algorithm I showed you. The basal dose, about 10 units at night, is 13, and you can give that once a day, or you might split it up twice a day. And then the bolus dose, 4 units at each meal. So now you try. I'll give you a second to fill in the blanks. If this patient weighs 80 kilograms, how much insulin would they need a day? And then how much of that would be basal, and how much of that would be bolus? All right, I'm just going to keep moving forward. So 80 times 0.5 is 40 units a day. Half of that is basal, 20 units. So that might be glargine at bedtime or maybe in the morning, or maybe we split it up. And the other half is a bolus. So 20 divided by 3 meals is 7, 7, and 6 approximately. And so now, remember that patient we just saw, he weighed 80 kilograms, 80 times 0.5 is 40. So let's use the 50-50 rule on him and see what his insulin dose really should be. So he takes 40 units a day, half of that would be basal, so here it is, 20 units of Dedimer. And then we said the other half, the other 20 you divide by 3 meals, so here's 7, 7, and 6. We assigned the 7 to the bigger meals of the day because we thought, you know, he was eating more, and 6 for his lighter meals of the day. So now let's take a look and see how his blood sugars are doing. They have really improved, and this is what I see all the time with patients. They come in on these kind of unusual insulin schemes, and then we apply the formula and we can really improve things. It's really terrific to see this happen. So now we see the blood sugars are usually within target. We had this 208. Where did that come from? Well, probably cake at lunch. So that's not a pattern. That's just a blip in the screen. I'm not too worried about that. We're going to do problem solving around that. But what I am worried about is the following, 84, 81, 79, 69. He's coming down over time. That's also a pattern. His blood sugars are trending down. So when you get to what I call the sweet spot, you're given the right amount of insulin. Sometimes we need to cut back on the insulin dose a little bit. At what time of day? At night. It's the night detomere that's making this morning blood sugar go too low. And so even though we use this formula, the formula really worked because it got him to the right insulin dosing, and now his blood sugars are trending down. He's really improving things. So we're going to have to reduce his detomere by 10% or 4 units, whatever greater. So we're going to go down to 16 units on the detomere. And then just help coach him with eating as carbohydrates and activity level. Okay, this is the AACE algorithm, and it's actually saying almost exactly the same thing as what I just said in a different little format, which you can read later. But it says, it talks about basal insulin. Total daily dose is 0.2 units of insulin per kilogram per day. It's exactly what we said, 0.2 units of basal. But if that doesn't work and the blood sugars start going up, we want to intensify. And then they say, the total daily dose is 0.3 to 0.5 units per kilogram, and half of it basal, half of it bolus or prandial. And they give some more details here that you can read through that I think are really interesting. But this is the AACE algorithm, which really follows the 50-50 rule. But let's take a look at another patient. He's Mr. R. He's, based on his clinical picture, how much insulin would he need? He has elevated creatinine, he's older, he's not really hungry, he's pretty lean. He's on glucotrol, which is sulfonylurea at home, and his A1C 7.2. So he's really has pretty good diabetes control. And so I want to say, like I said, the most common starting dose is body weight in kilograms times 0.5. But in his situation, that would be too much. We would do more toward the 0.3. For thin elderly patients with elevated creatinines, we start at a lower total daily dose. But if he's heavy or infected or on steroids, we might start at 0.5 and need to go more rapidly to 1 unit of insulin per kilogram per day. So it really depends on the patient's presentation. In this situation, if we did 80 kilograms times 0.3, he would need 24 units a day, half basal, half bolus. And that 12 units of bolus we divide by 3 meals. Okay, so let's talk a little bit about carbohydrate and prandial coverage. And when we talk about, so we talked about just doing a formula to figure out their bolus insulin, but what if we want to stick it up a notch, you know, ramp it up a notch and do some more carbohydrate counting, a little more sophisticated. And then if we're going to do that, adjust the bolus insulin based on their intake plus their blood sugar level at that moment, here's some formulas that we could use. And as I mentioned before, if we're doing carb counting, a common starting point is 1 unit of insulin for 15 grams. And then we have to target hyperglycemia. And this target is really based on a lot of factors, body weight and total insulin dose being two considerations, but generally 1 unit for every 50 points over target, and then we keep adjusting. So let's take a look at this gal. She takes 1 unit of insulin for every 15 grams. So, for example, for dinner, she's going to have lemon chicken, 1 cup of rice pilaf, asparagus, and dinner roll for a total of 60 grams of carb. She takes 1 unit for every 15 grams, so she has a little chart that she uses, that she ate 4 servings of carbohydrate or 60 grams. To cover that, she needs 4 units. And so patients would have that ability to know, oh, I'm 1 for 15. If I eat 60 grams, I need 4 grams of carbohydrate. But in addition to that, when you're thinking about carbohydrate coverage, they also need to ask themselves some other questions. You know, how much am I going to eat? What is my insulin dose? Should I lower the dose because I plan to be very active or have recently been active? Because being active lowers your blood sugar and you may need less insulin, or my blood sugar is low. So it's not just a straight formula. that I'm going to eat this much, I take this much insulin, we have to consider other factors. And if you notice from that case study, before Cindy was going to eat, her blood sugar was 165. So she's above her target. She's at 165. So to cover for that, she would take one unit in addition to the 4 units to cover for the food. So she would take 5 units. But something really important I want to point out, if her blood sugar was less than 70, she would subtract 1 unit. So instead of taking 4 units to cover that meal, she would take 3 because she's already starting below her target. What I like to do is do a poll question using this notion. So this patient uses one, this is different, so just pay attention to this because I changed it. She uses 1 unit of aspart or Novolog for every 10 grams of carb, 10 grams of carb. She's going to eat 1 cup of rice, barbecued steak, 1 cup of skim milk, small banana, sugar-free iced tea. Her blood glucose is 68, and the patient deducts 1 unit of insulin if her blood sugar is less than 70. So how much insulin would she need? You know what, I'm going to close the poll for a second and just let you look at this slide because it might give you. So this is a time where you get out your pen and paper because during this the test, you will have questions that you need to write out with pen and paper and figure it out. So she takes, let's just do it one more time, 1 unit of aspart or Novolog for 10 grams of carb. She's going to have 1 cup of rice, barbecued steak, 1 cup skim milk, small banana, sugar-free iced tea. Her blood glucose is 68, and she deducts 1 unit if her blood sugar is less than 70. How much insulin would she need? Now I'm going to post this again. And she's not on an insulin pump, she's injecting. Oh, you know what, guys? I'm sorry. I think I closed it because I already showed it. So let's just do it together. That's more fun anyway. Okay. So 1 cup of rice is how many grams of carbohydrate? 45 grams. It's 3 servings. What about barbecued steak? It's not a carbohydrate. Even though there's barbecue sauce on it, it's really not enough to count. So that's 45 grams. 1 cup of skim milk is 12 grams of carbohydrate. So 45 plus 12 is 57. There's a small banana, and that's 15. So that's 72 grams of carbohydrate. Iced tea is free. We're at 72 grams of carbohydrate, but her blood glucose is 68. So let's just keep thinking. If she's on 72 grams of carbohydrate, she takes 1 for every 10. So 72 divided by 10 is 7.2, but she's on a syringe, so she can't take that. So she would take 7 units, but now that we've considered her blood glucose is less than 70, at 68, we're going to deduct 1. So the right answer is D, 6 units of insulin. Did you all get that right? I can't see you, so I don't know, but if you did, great job. So will they ask these kind of questions on the exam? Yes. They're going to give you a situation where the patient's eating food. They give you the ratio. They'll tell you they take 1 unit for every 10 grams of carb, and you have to figure out how many grams of carbs. So we'll go over that later in the nutrition section, but you definitely want to be familiar with exchanges. And then you need to calculate how much insulin would they take based on that. So I hope that you felt good about that. And if not, I put a lot of practice questions in your online university figuring out those types of situations. Let's just take a look at Cindy. Cindy's trying to carb count and adjust her insulin, but she's having trouble. She weighs 60 kilograms. What is her daily dose of insulin? So let's just think about this. 60 times 0.5. She takes 30 units of insulin a day. That's her dose. What's her basal dose? So 30 divided by in half is 15 for her basal. So we know her basal is 15. Her pre-meal target is 120, and her post-meal goal is 180. She takes 1 unit for every 15 grams of carbohydrate. And then here's her correction factor. I'm not going to go over this now. I've written over here. It's based on the 1700 rule. So you don't need to calculate anything using the 1700 rule. I just might mention it. But the main thing you need to work with is that based on that rule, she takes 1 unit of insulin for every 55 above target. That's her correction scale. Okay, let's keep going. So here's a correction bolus for Cindy. They've written it out for her, so she doesn't have to do the math in her head. Her blood sugar is less than 70. You subtract 1 unit, 70 to 119, nothing. 120 to 175. So every 55 above 119, she takes an additional unit. So based on this scale, let's just go. I'm going to skip that poll question for now. Let's just look at a situation. Her Cindy's before lunch blood glucose is 285, and she plans to eat 45 grams of carbohydrate. How much insulin does she need to take? So let's just go over this. She's 285 and her target's 120. So we know she's 165 over her target. And we know that her correction scale is 55, 1 unit for every 55 above target. So if we take her over target of 165 divided by her correction, which is 55, she needs 3 units of bolus to correct for her hyperglycemia. But she's going to eat 45 grams of carbohydrate. So we say 45 grams divided by 15, because that's her ratio, 1 for every 15 units. I'm sorry, she takes 1 unit for every 15 grams of carbohydrate. She would need 3 to cover her carbs. So she needs 3 units of bolus insulin to correct for hyperglycemia and 3 units of bolus to cover carbs in meal for a total of 6 units. So this is a more advanced way that people would actually figure out how much insulin to take based on their carb and their hyperglycemia. And a lot of patients on insulin pumps do this too. So they're going to calculate out how much insulin they need based on what they're going to eat, what their blood sugar is at that moment, and enter that into the insulin pump. So what I'd like to do, I'm going to leave that one for you all to figure out on your own, but I do want to do one more poll here. Launch. I try to give you some extra work that you could do on your own. So let's take a look at this poll. Bob's correction scale is 1 unit for every 30 above his target of 120. His blood glucose right now is 270. How much correction insulin would he need to take? Okay, you guys are doing a great job. So I'm going to go over this a little bit while you're working on it. Bob takes 1 unit for every 30 above his target of 120. His blood sugar right now is 270. So you have to think, how much is he above his target? Well, his target is 120. He's 270 right now. So he's 150 above his target. His blood sugar is 150 above target. He takes 1 unit for every 30 above target. So he's 150 above. You divide that by 30, that equals 5 units. Exactly. And I'm going to share this with you guys because you got it right, 100% of you. 5 units. And on the exam, they might ask you to do that. So you could just make up your own questions and practice this because that would really help out a lot. And again, I've put some extra questions in your handout that you can practice, and I've also put extra questions in the online university. I want to do one more poll for you all. Which of the following is not a clinical indication for patients to start an insulin pump? Now, we haven't talked about indications for insulin pumps, but in the handout that I mentioned, the white paper on continuous insulin infusion, they do talk about that in detail. So that would be a good paper for you to go over to evaluate who would be a good candidate and what are some of the consideration. So which of the following is not a clinical indicator to start somebody on an insulin pump? All right, I'm going to go ahead and close this and share with all of you. And you guys are doing a great job. 60% of you got this right. Actually, gastroparesis, high glucose variability, and hypoglycemia are some good reasons to start an insulin pump, because those patients are really having a hard time getting their glucose to target. But the group who would not be a candidate are patients with a history of substance abuse, because they may not be able to have the follow-through or the reliability to really do this safely. All right, I'm going to do one last poll question. I know our time is coming to an end, and I think this kind of summarizes it nice. Which of the following is an accurate insulin teaching key? Which of the following is an accurate insulin teaching key? Okay, it looks like I hit the close button, so I'm sorry, but let me share this with all of you. So the first answer was insulin should never be injected through the close. Whenever you see the word never in an answer, it's usually the wrong answer. If you see the word never, always, and so forth, because you can't inject insulin through the close, especially if it's like nylons or a thin piece of clothing, it's okay. So always be suspicious. I'm going to share this with all of you for a second. When you see any answer with the word never, but half of you got it right. Test blood glucose, inject, and eat. I call this the tie. Test, inject, eat. That is very, very important for your patients to know. Insulin, as far as refrigeration, when you're not using it, it needs to be refrigerated, but once you take it out of the fridge, it's good for 28 days. And as far as reusing needles, we really recommend that patients don't reuse them because they get dull. But if they do reuse them, just put the cap back on. You don't need to clean them at all. And here's some of the insulin teaching keys that you want to be familiar with, for your patients and also for the exam. So thank you so much. I put some additional information on here and some additional case studies where you could practice with this. And if you have any questions on these case studies, let me know. But I just feel like the more you practice with it and sit with yourself quietly, it becomes more apparent. So we did move through the content. You know, there's a lot of information to cover, and I want to get the basics across. But a lot of this is going to be studying on your own and with your group of friends, and of course asking any questions. I'll be happy to get back to you on those also. So our time has come to an end. As always, I'll be online to answer any questions afterward, and if you have any questions that are lingering, you certainly can email me after the program. So thank you so much for joining us, and I'll be here to answer any questions afterward. And you all have a great day, the rest of you. And thank you for all the good work you're doing for patients with diabetes. I really appreciate it.